Everybody, we are going to be doing our Midrash for this week on our triennial Torah portion readings consisting of Exodus chapter 26 verses 31 through chapter 27 verse 19, Ezekiel chapter 16 verses 10 through 19, Psalm 58, and Matthew in chapter 23. And verses 1 through 28. I'm going to begin by reviewing the text, Exodus chapter 26 and verse 31. And you shall make a veil of blue and purple and scarlet and fine twine linen of cunning work. With cherubim shall it be made. And you shall hang it upon four pillars of shittim wood overlaid with gold. Their hooks shall be of gold, upon the four sockets of silver. And you shall hang up the veil under the tacks, that you may bring in thither within the veil the ark of testimony. And the veil shall divide unto you between the holy place and the most holy. And you shall put the mercy seat upon the ark of the testimony in the most holy place. And you shall set the candle, you shall set the table without the veil, and the candlestick over against the table on the side of the tabernacle toward the south. And you shall put the table on the north side. And you shall make a hanging for the door of the tent of blue and purple and scarlet and fine twine linen wrought with needlework. And you shall make for the hanging five pillars of shittim wood and overlay them with gold, and their hooks shall be of gold, and you shall cast five sockets of brass for them. This is describing the veil of the temple that hung between the holy place and the most holy. And then it describes that which was to be set in the most holy place of all. Now, because it mentions a holy place, but what's commonly called the Holy of Holies, or here, the most holy, we can see from this a principle that there are levels of holiness. There are levels of holiness that we walk in. And where the Shekinah, or the divine presence, dwelt, which was the Holy of Holies, is regarded as the Holy of Holies, the most holy, and the Shekinah is the divine presence of the God of Israel. So we can see that the highest place of holiness is where the presence of the Holy Spirit is, where the Shekinah is, where the presence of the God of Israel. When you're in and within His presence, that is when you are in the most holy place. So where is His presence supposed to dwell with us? It is supposed to dwell in our hearts. Our heart is to be, it's really who we are. Our heart is really who we are. It makes up who we are. Things proceed from the heart. The issues of life proceed from the heart. So what is near and dear to our heart is what we value. And His Spirit and His Torah is to be written upon our heart. And so this teaches us that our hearts is the most holiest place of all. This is why the God of Israel says that he looks into the heart, and he's a discerner of the thought and the intent of the heart, because the true desires and the true motives of a person is contained in their heart. And we are able, in some form or fashion as human beings, to camouflage for a while, for a time being, what is in our hearts. But ultimately, we will end up doing and speaking what is truly, and taking action regarding what is truly within the center of our hearts. So that's why the scripture teaches that everything will be revealed. And so the Holy of Holies in the tabernacle is a teaching, a prophetic picture to us that our goal and purpose and desire should be in to dwell and to be in the presence, the divine presence of the God of Israel. And since our bodies is multidimensional, it's likened unto a tabernacle as well. The God of Israel wants his presence in our most holiest place of all, which is our hearts. And that's my thoughts on this. There's many different angles and perspectives that one can take from this. So does anybody else in the congregation or in Pow Talk Land have any further thoughts, questions, comments about the end of Exodus in chapter 26? Exodus chapter 26. Anyone here in the congregation have anything? Mark?
just noticed something coincidental. As you know, there's nothing coincidental, really. Thou shalt set the table without the veil, and the candlestick over against the table on the side of the tabernacle toward the south, and thou shalt put the table on the north side. Okay, so the menorah is on the south side of the holy place, and the table is on the north side. The table is called the table of the presence, or the table of the face of Yahweh. Okay, the Panim. And it's just interesting to me that in Isaiah 28, I think it is. In Isaiah 14, where you see Hasatan, says that he will make his throne in the sides of the north. And so the idea, I think, being that he wanted to take the place of Yahweh in that holy place. Just something I saw here a second ago. Table of the bread of the presence is the sides of the north, if you think about it. Okay, so.
Well, we know that Hasatan wanted the throne of Yahweh himself. So his throne is where his presence is.
Something interesting that I remember from the last church that I was in, one of the pastors was doing a book by book, chapter by chapter study through the Tanakh, and my train of thought just derailed. Thanks a lot, Eddie. It's all your fault.
Hey, it'll come back.
The throne. My old pastor taught me, or taught us as the whole church. It was a pretty good sized church. Anyway, that after when the earth was first made, and Hasatan was created before man was, that he had dominion over the earth, and that was where he wanted to put his throne, was in Jerusalem. Okay, and I don't know, I don't remember, it's been well over 10 years, and I only heard this one time, but that was just an interesting thing, that the reason that the fight is going on over Jerusalem in particular is because that's where Hasatan wants his throne to be. That's where it was before man was put on the earth. And that's what I remember anyway.
Well, this earth and the things that happen into it is a microcosm of what's happening in the spirit world. And I always believed that the heavens and the earth were created in Genesis chapter 1 as a result of the original conflict between Yahweh and Hasatan, and that things on the earth were going to play out and things were going to come to a climax regarding the exact same issues of the original rebellion. And it's through the creation of the earth, the things that ultimately end up happening, Yahweh was going to show his justice and his mercy, and how he did handle, is handling, and will handle the rebellion of Hasatan. So, if he originally tried to take his throne before the creation of the heavens and the earth, and Yahweh set up Jerusalem to be the capital of the nation of Israel, Hasatan has to, in order to take control of the world, want to set up his throne in Jerusalem as well. And that's why ultimately the conflict in the end of days is about Jerusalem, because the conflict in the beginning was about the throne, or about Jerusalem and who was going to sit on that throne, who was going to rule and reign in the universe, or who's going to rule and reign in the earth. And so I concur, I believe, with the thought that you shared, Ron.
Yes, in Yahweh revealing the different details of this tabernacle, this is of course before the rebellion of the golden calf, he's revealing to his bride the intimate details of his relationship with her, with his desire to draw Israel into an intimate oneness relationship, in being able to come to the most intimate location in the very presence and heart of Elohim himself, and being able to go through these various positions of set apartness, from being outside of the tabernacle, the linen wall that goes around it, and then entering into the court itself. It just, for us, it should show that much more how his heart is for intimacy and relationship. And even though it was cut off by the exiling of the nation Israel, he is once again has drawn us to a place where we can enter into that through Messiah, through Yeshua. But again, we're still in that betrothal period of time, and so we have that time to be able to prepare ourselves as a bride. The marriage of his lamb has come, and his bride has made herself ready. So we're at a time right now where we can be a part of all the goings on of the tabernacle. And as Eddie was pointing out, the tabernacle is in the deepest place, recesses of our heart and the very spirit, that's seated in the holy places of heaven with Messiah Yeshua. But experiencing that is a part of the daily cleansing or sanctification that we have to go through. And we do need it. I know I need it. I just think of the thoughts and things that enter in, and like careless words, or even my own physical desires for certain things. I get up out of the bed. How am I going to be this morning? You know, we have to be intentional about how we approach this act of coming into oneness with him, this act of very communion with the set apart being in all the universe who's brought us into being for relationship with him.
We have a question on Pal Talk. Eddie, you're not saying or implying that humans are nothing more than pawns in a cosmic power struggle, are you? I'm not saying that we're pawns. Pawns implies that we have no choice in the matter. If we are in this world and we believe that the Bible, and the Bible tells us that there is one God who's the king of the universe, who had a cosmic power struggle before the creation of the heavens and the earth. That's what the Bible tells us. And the Bible also tells us that in the end of what we call time on this earth, that Satan is going to, and those who are part of his kingdom are going to be thrown into the lake of fire, and we are going to judge the angels. Well, HaSatan is a fallen angel, so if we're going to judge angels, then we have a link with this world on earth and a link with the world that we can't see with our physical eyes. But the God of Israel has given us a choice. We all are given a choice as to whether we're going to serve the king of the universe or we're going to be a part of a rebellion against him, and that attitude that we don't want to embrace his love and his mercy that he tries to show toward us.
Reflecting on that question and comment, I think about the story of Job. Now, he was not privy to what happened in heaven in regards to when the sons of God presented themselves, and then there was this challenge to one of God's beloved, being Job. Now, Elohim allowed Job to go through a series of very difficult challenges in regards to having all of his wealth taken, his health destroyed, all of his family except for his wife to be taken, and only his wife to be left. And even his friends that came to comfort him, none of them expressed a deeper understanding of what he was going through. They didn't understand what was actually taking place in regards to the contest. Not saying that Elohim has just reserved us for being the pawns, but there are times when he chooses to not to allow us to be privy to those things that are going on in his economy. Now, certain things are set apart as mysteries that we know, but certain mysteries have been coming to light and becoming made known to us as a greater revelation because of history is pushing us to that place of the end. But even when we get to the end of the story of Job, even Elohim himself, Yahweh does not reveal to Job or to any of his friends what actually took place. And so there is this paradigm in which we are participants, but yet we are set apart as given a great responsibility and a great honor, as Eddie pointed out. And so all the things that happened to Job were then given back to him in a sense that he was blessed doubly with his wealth. He was given sons and daughters and his health and his time. So Yahweh is very much concerned about our welfare, and he loves us very much, and he is concerned about even providing for us a place and a position in his government. But there are certain things that he doesn't want us to be privy to at certain times in his dealings with his working out of his governmental policies and bringing his governmental judgments, which extend beyond the physical world that we understand.
Yeah, we don't even come close to knowing all the things that happened before the creation of Adam and Eve, but I think we were given enough that the Creator wanted us to know to be able to make sense and answer the question, why are we here and what are our purpose and what's the purpose of the earth and in the universe? Go ahead.
Yeah, but I think it's in Romans where Paul wrote that eye hath not seen nor ear heard, neither has it entered into the mind of man the things that Yahweh has for us.
I think 1 Corinthians 2.
1 Corinthians, okay, 1 Corinthians, I'm sorry. I know it's a Pauline thing. Anyway, it just meshes perfectly with what Ron was just saying here and what Eddie just elaborated on. And I wanted to bring something else out about that table of the presence. I think that what that is, the table itself and the accoutrements thereof, are referring to New Jerusalem, or they symbolize New Jerusalem. And the when we the 12 tribes will encamp in the presence of Yahweh forever. And I think that's what the picture is of the 12 loaves of bread on the table, and that being the table of the presence, where we are face to face with Yahweh, 12 tribes face to face with Him, Panaim et Panaim.
Okay, what you was referring to is found in two places. Isaiah 64:4. For since the beginning of the world, men have not heard, nor perceived by the ear, neither has the eye seen, O God, besides you, what He has prepared for those that wait for Him. And Paul renders it this way in 1 Corinthians 2, verse 9. As it is written, eye has not seen, nor ear heard, neither has entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for them that love Him. Anybody else have any further thoughts, questions, comments about this thread or the text itself? I mean, we were talking about the text.
But just can't wait for the new heaven and the new earth and the new Jerusalem, where we'll be encamped with the Yah for eternity. Won't that be a cool thing?
That will be. All right. We are going to allow Water Garden to come to the mic and to make a comment about the things we're reading about the tabernacle itself. Water Garden, the mic is now yours.
Okay, thank you. It's nothing profound, but I was looking at the different colors that's discussing that they used in the linen, and one of the things that I found about the scarlet, maybe everybody already knows this, but I thought this was very beautiful, that the children of Israel used this worm called the Sirmes vermillo worm. And what she does is she gives birth to her young, and she attaches herself so firmly to a trunk of a tree that she never leaves it. And then she protects like her eggs underneath her body until they hatch. And she's dying in this process. And as she does die, she gives off this crimson fluid that stains her body and the bodies of her babies underneath her and also on the wood surrounding her, the tree. And when I was reading about that, it's in the Bible, Biblical Basis for Modern Science. That's such a picture of Messiah who died on the tree, and He shed His blood as a judgment for the sins of us. And actually, what it made me think of was Psalms 22:6, but I am a worm and no man, and a reproach of men and despised of the people. And so I was just thinking that at least the scarlet symbolizes the blood of Yeshua that was shed on a tree for the judgment and condemnation of all the sins of mankind. And that made me remember Isaiah 1:18, and it says, come now and let us reason together, saith Adonai, though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be white as snow. Though they be like crimson, the scarlet color of like the worm, we shall be washed clean and made white as snow, or white as the lamb's wool. And I kind of thought that tied in with what you all have been saying about the bride.
Thank you so much for sharing. Does anyone have any thought, question, comment about what Water Garden shared, or anything else regarding the text here? That we're looking at the end of Exodus in chapter 26. All right, so let's continue on then. In Exodus in chapter 27, Exodus to chapter 27, verse 1, "And you shall make an altar of shittim wood, 5 cubits long, 5 cubits broad. The altar shall be 4 square, and the height thereof shall be 3 cubits. And you will make the horns of it upon the 4 corners thereof. His horns shall be of the same. You shall overlay it with brass. And you shall make his pans to receive his ashes, and his shovels, and his basins, and his flesh hooks, and his fire pans. All the vessels thereof you shall make of brass. And you shall make for it a crate of network of brass, and upon the net shall you make 4 brazen rings in the 4 corners thereof. And you shall put it under the compass of the altar beneath, that the net may be even in the midst of the altar. And you shall make stays for the altar, stays of shittim wood, overlay them with brass. And the stays shall be put into the rings, and the stays shall be upon the 2 sides of the altars to bear it. Hollow with boards shall you make it, as it was shown you in the mount, so shall you make it." Anybody have thoughts, questions, comments about these first 8 verses? It's describing an altar. Of course, we know, and this is why we have our Brit Hadashah portion, to Yahweh, the altar, what the altar consists of, and what is put upon it is extremely important. And so, describing this altar and having it, we need to not consider or to take it lightly, but the altar is very important because this is where what you present to Yahweh, this is what it's going to be done upon. And in a way, then, our heart is an altar before Him. Because what we do in service to Yahweh, we are to do from the heart, with all of our hearts. So we are to lay our service on Him upon His altar, upon our hearts. And in doing so, we should approach what we do with the right attitude and with the right motive. So that if we do not prepare the altar, then what we do is not acceptable to Yahweh. If the altar is not right, if the heart is not right, even what we do doesn't please Him if we are not doing it with the right motive and with the right attitude. Anybody else with thoughts, questions, comments? We are looking at Exodus 27, verses 1 through 8. Exodus 27, verses 1 through 8. In Pal Talk or in the congregation? Okay, well, go ahead.
Just one real quick thing in verse 8, where it says that it's made after the pattern that you saw in the mountain. He doesn't say how he wants the thing constructed for Moses to write down. He tells him, this is the stuff you're going to use, this is the sizes you're going to use, and you're going to make it the way that you saw it. and therefore there's no way for us to know how this thing was built. If it was me, it would have been, you know, rabbit joints and, you know, maybe some dados here and there, whatever it took to get the thing to hold itself together. He doesn't tell us how it's done. So the best that we can do about that is to speculate. What we do know is that the size is 5 by 5, grace times grace, times 3, the perfection of Yah. Okay? The whole thing is overlaid with brass, something that looks pretty much like gold, but can handle the heat of the fire. It symbolizes judgment. So we keep all the, this is pretty much the best we can come to understand what the altar was about. It's a place of judgment. It's a place of grace times Yah's perfection. So we're talking about it. There's a lot of mercy and there's a lot of grace thrown into this altar, even though we have to kill an animal to put it on the altar. Okay, I've said it a few times in the last few months. I don't think that the sacrifices did anything. What they did was they showed that we were willing to do what Yah told us to do, in order to, okay, and they all pointed to Messiah. And the ones that will happen in the new temple when it's built, the ones used in the millennium, will still point to Messiah. So anyway. And it all has to do with mercy and grace.
As you were talking about the altar being made of brass or bronze, that's a man-made alloy. And so I would think that speaks of, you know, the man part of what we're giving to deal with. It's used for judgment to be able to remove that which is impure out of our lives. Whereas the other implements are made of silver and gold, which speak of the very majesty and the glory and the integrity of Elohim, whereas the bronze, which has to deal with the problems in our lives, making us clean, sanctifying us. And so for us to be as the altar in which we have to go through difficulties, even Messiah, when he was as a man, he learned obedience through the things that he suffered. And so we, by many tribulations, will we enter into the glory of heaven. And so in this world, we shall have the tribulations upon us, even though none of us relish or like them. It's a part of what we have to go through. There is, of course, the natural physical difficulties and challenges, the sufferings. And then there are also the supernatural sufferings on our behalf from Messiah Yeshua and others who intercede and pray. Many of us would have to agree that there have been many times in our lives that we've been preserved, not by our own prayers or not by anything that we've done for ourselves, but we would say that it was the grace and the mercy of Elohim himself, or we would point to someone who in our family has taken it upon themselves as a personal charge to intercede upon us and to hold us up before the very throne of Elohim, that we might be able to stand and be purified and go through various difficult places and be preserved.
Somebody asked a question in Pal Talk. When it says brass, how do we know it's brass and not pure copper? Well, the easiest way is to go back and look at the Hebrew word, and the Hebrew word is nekshet. It actually says nekoshet. And the word is translated 103 times as brass, only one time as copper. But in giving a detailed explanation, it says copper, comma, bronze, copper ore, bronze, as copper alloy, fetters of copper or bronze. Go ahead.
The Strong's literally says here copper, hence something made of that metal, i.e. a coin, a fetter. Gold or silver, which is a precious metal. And it's translated as brazen, brass, chain, copper, fetter, filthiness, and steel. The the Tanakh, the I should say, the stones Chumash, the translation there, I believe, is the stones Torah. It says copper. The fact is that brass, or rather bronze, which most of the newer translations say, is an alloy of copper and brass. Copper, I'm sorry, you're right. Copper and tin. Copper and tin. And I don't know whether to use that as a... I don't know why the King James uses brass. Maybe that's what they called copper back then. I don't know.
Anybody else? Thoughts, questions, comments? Well, let's continue on. Verse 9 of Exodus 27. And this is describing the enclosure of the tabernacle. Mark, you got
to
follow up.
Yeah, to follow up. I'm looking in the Webster's 1828 dictionary under copper. And it says, supposed to be called, to be so called from Cyprus, an island in the Mediterranean. This opinion is probable as the Greeks called it Cyprian brass, or brass of Cyprus. It is the base. In this base, copper was originally an adjective, so it wasn't really a noun talking about a particular thing called copper. A metal of a pale red color tinged with yellow. Next to gold, silver, and platina, it is the most ductible and malleable of the metals, and it is more elastic than any metal except steel, and the most sonorous of all metals. The whole idea is that copper is a proper translation, and the Greeks called it Cyprian brass. And so you can see where those two translations came from. And the bronze being an alloy of tin and copper, you can see where that could be a possibility as well.
Okay, verse 9, you shall make the court of the tabernacle. For the south side southward, there shall be hangings for the court of fine twined linen of 100 cubits long for one side, and 20 pillars thereof in their sockets shall be of brass. The hooks of the pillars and their fillets shall be of silver. And likewise for the north side in length, there shall be hangings of 100 cubits long, and its 20 pillars and their 20 sockets of brass. The hooks of the pillars and their fillets of silver. And for the breadth of the court on the west side shall be hangings of 50 cubits, their pillars 10, and their sockets 10. And the breadth of the court on the east side eastward shall be 50 cubits. The hangings on one side of the gate shall be 15 cubits, their pillars 3, and their sockets 3. And on the other side shall be hanging 15 cubits, their pillars 3, their sockets 3. And for the gate of the court shall be a hanging of 20 cubits, of blue and purple and scarlet and fine twined linen, wrought with needlework. And their pillars shall be 4, and their sockets 4. All the pillars round about the court shall be filleted with silver. Their hooks shall be of silver, and their sockets of brass. The length of the court shall be 100 cubits, and the breadth 50 everywhere. And the height 5 cubits of fine twine linen, and their sockets of brass. All the vessels of the tabernacle, and all the service thereof, and all the pins thereof, and all the pins of the court shall be of brass. Any thoughts, questions, comments about these things? Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question. Verse 16, where it says, and fine woven linen, made by a weaver. I noticed yours says but anyway, it says made by a weaver, whereas most of the other verses, when it's talking about putting together curtains or garments of fine woven linen, it's by, verse 31, and you shall make a veil of blue and purple and scarlet material and fine woven linen, the work of a skilled workman made with cherubim. So... is that really what is it? I mean, is it with the work of angels? I don't understand what it means, the difference of the two.
What's the... Go ahead, Mark.
I believe what it's talking about there, where it says made with cherubim, it means that it's first of all, it's a fine. It says in the King James, fine twined linen, woven with needlework. Okay, so I'm thinking that what we're talking about is that it's a fine linen made on a loom of some kind, and then I believe there's gold involved here. I believe that it's gold thread that they use to shape to put in the shape of a cherubim, okay, or an angel, into the. That's what I think, but that's every representation I've ever seen of it was like that anyway.
When it's sewn together with gold, I would think that it's actually the thread is gold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that if it's a woven thing, the warp and woof are woven into the linen, and then I believe that it's a gold thread that's used to make the shape of the cherubim in the, but I don't know. I'm looking for that now.
Let's continue on in the last. Let's see. We were supposed to read through verse 19. That's our portion then for Exodus. We have a question from Paltalk. What do the colors blue, purple, and scarlet represent?
Blue represents the Shamayim, the heavens. Purple represents royalty. Red, sacrifice, blood.
Redemption.
So that all talks about Messiah himself. And then gold is the most precious thing on earth, according to tradition. So
remember this as we're looking through this. The things that are given to us is to teach us about the Messiah, to teach us about the kingdom of heaven, and principles of the kingdom of heaven, and what our obligations and our responsibilities are in service to the God of Israel. If you examine what you're reading in that light, it will have better practicality for you rather than reading about some historical thing and a historical construction. Because we're told in Hebrews chapter 8 verse 5 that the tabernacle is patterned after the true one in heaven. And Yahweh was very specific that you make it after the pattern that I show you. And so it's meant to teach us this, and it says about the future temple in Ezekiel 43, verses 10 through 12, that the temple, its construction and its services will teach you about the ways of the kingdom of heaven. Ron?
Just a verse to go along with what Andy's saying there. Deuteronomy chapter 29 and verse 29. The secret things belong to Yahweh our Elohim, but the things revealed belong to us and to our sons forever, that we may observe the words of this law.
And notice that it says, this is the King James in Exodus 27:16. Fine twine linen wrought with needlework. Fine twine linen wrought with needlework. Well, Psalm 45 is entitled, it's given the description of a royal wedding song. And it says, verse 11, so shall the king greatly desire your beauty. And it's describing the king's daughter. And it goes on to say, verse 13, the king's daughter is all glorious within. Her clothing is of wrought gold. She shall be brought unto the king in raiment of needlework. She shall be brought to the king in raiment of needlework. So the needlework is a picture of the bride.
I wasn't reading in there, but it says wrought with needlework. If you think about what wrought iron is, it's iron that's been shaped into a particular shape, okay? And I think that that's where I get the idea that the gold thread is used to make a representation of something into the woven linen. That's
very good. So now, in completing the portion from Exodus, we go forward to Ezekiel in chapter 16. Ezekiel chapter 16. Actually, this chapter starts out by describing the birth of the nation and how the nation grew just like a human being grows. And a human being grows up in physical maturity to the place and time where you physically get to adulthood. And it's describing the experience of the nation of Israel in this same way in Ezekiel 16 and verses 1 through 9. And that the nation of Israel was brought to the place where she was ready to be the bride of Yahweh. And he adorned, and she was adorned and dressed so beautifully. But it, as our portion where we pick up goes on to say, that she went and she played the harlot. So, Ezekiel 6, verses 10 through 19. I clothed you with embroidered work and shod you with badger skin. I girded you about with fine linen and I covered you with silk. This is describing the birth of the nation of Israel going back to Abraham. And even as the tabernacle contained these different elements and in embroidered work, even so, Israel as a nation being redeemed out of Egypt is described as being adorned as a bride. And it says, I decked you with ornaments, I put bracelets on your hands and a chain on your neck, I put a jewel on your forehead, earrings in your ears, and a beautiful crown upon your head. You were decked with gold and silver, and your raiment was of fine linen, silk, and embroidered work. You did eat flour and honey and oil, and you was exceedingly beautiful, and you did prosper into a kingdom. Your renown went forth among the heathen for your beauty, for it was perfect through your comeliness, which I put upon you, says Yahweh Elohim. But you trusted in your own beauty. Now, remember earlier we had the conversation about making the connection about this cosmic struggle that happened in the heavenlies before the creation of Adam and Eve, and it's being played out in the earth. And through the people Israel, notice that the nation of Israel in coming out of Egypt being redeemed, that she's ordained as a bride and her beauty is as a bride. But then it says in verse 15, she trusted in her own beauty. She's beautiful as a bride, but she trusted in her own beauty. And that became her fall. And there, she committed harlotry. Well, let's parallel this with Ezekiel chapter 28. It says, verse 13, You've been in the Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering. The sardis, the topaz, the diamond, beryl, the onyx, the jasper, the sapphire, the emerald, the carbuncle, the gold. The workmanship of your tabrets and of your pipes was prepared in you in the day that you were created. You are the anointed cherub that covers, and I have set you so. You was upon the holy mountain of Elohim. You walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire. You was perfect in all your ways from the day that you were created. Look, till iniquity was found in you. Got puffed up from the beauty, from the ordainment. So Hasatan got puffed up in his position of his authority. And the glory that was to go to Yahweh, he wanted to bring the attention to himself. And you know, when we fall, either individually or in ministry, you'll be able to see that's it. And this is how we limit Yahweh's blessing upon our lives and upon our ministries, is when we get puffed up in ourselves. We think we're a great teacher, or we think that it's because our hard work or whatever is why the success came about. And we refuse to give Yahweh glory. We refuse to give Him glory, and we bring attention to us, and we want people to think we're something. That's where the downfall, getting puffed up in the anointing, getting puffed up in the success, getting puffed up in the beauty. And once that pride sets in on us and we don't give the glory to Yeshua, you know what we're going to end up doing? We'll play the harlot. Go ahead.
That reminds me of Romans chapter 7, where Paul is talking about, he said, first of all, I would not have known that there was any such thing as lust if the Torah had not told me, thou shalt not covet. And then he goes on to talk about how he wants to do the Torah, and the flesh is with him that keeps him from doing it. And I get the idea from reading that Paul's major problem was his covetousness. That's the thorn that he had in his flesh. And it wasn't that he coveted to have things that other people had, but he coveted to keep that which he originally had. And he talks about that in, I believe it's in Colossians chapter 2, where he talks about, I'm a Hebrew of Hebrews. I am of the tribe of Benjamin. As counting the law, a Pharisee. Okay, and he talks about all this stuff, and you can almost read in that he had pride in having all that stuff and in the position that he had. And I think that's the covetousness that he recognized in himself, and that he was trying to constantly keep that down, that covetousness. And it's that exactly that Satan had in the original creation. He saw how beautiful he was. He saw how wise he was. And his covetousness for those things is what drove him to his rebellion. And I think that Paul saw that and realized that if he kept up with his covetousness, he'd end up being just like Hasatan. And that was why he constantly was working to keep it under. He said, I die daily. Okay? He died to himself daily. Because he had to do that. He had to do it regularly in order for him to not be like Hasatan. And it's that example that we need to look at as well in our own lives. Because you know what? Every once in a while, I get the idea that, you know, I'm a pretty good teacher of the Torah, too. You know what? That's a bad attitude to have. It's a real bad attitude to have. It'll end up getting you puffed up and you thinking that you're all that in a bag of chips, when in fact, you're a cow pie out in the middle of the field.
That's exactly right. Sometimes we have to be... Sometimes it might be better for us if we are humbled by cow pie. Just walk through the pastures and...
And every once in a while you go, oh my goodness, what is that? Oh, that's me. Oh. did not Paul say that he counted it all done?
That's right.
That's exactly right. Is all that stuff that he coveted, he counted it all done. It was cow pie to him. Absolutely.
Let's continue on. Ezekiel 16, verse 15. You did trust in your own beauty. You played the harlot because of your renown, and you poured out your fornication on everyone that passed by. His it was. And of your garments you did take, and you decked your high places with diverse colors, and you played the harlot thereupon. The like shall not come, neither shall it be so. You have also taken your fair jewels of my gold and of my silver, which I have given you, and made to yourself images of men, and you did commit whoredom with them. And you took your embroidered garment and covered them, and you have set my oil and my incense before them. My meat also, which I gave you, fine flour, oil, and honey, I fed you. You have even set it before them for a sweet savor, and thus it was, says Yahweh Elohim. Mark.
Thou hast also taken thy fair jewels and my gold and my silver, in verse 17, which I had given thee, and madest thou to thyself images of men. The image in anytime King James is talking about images, more often than not it's talking about obelisks and such like, and they are images of they're phallic symbols. Okay? And I think that's what this is talking about when it says images of men. It's talking about they made actual representations of it. And out of the things that Yahweh had given them, all they're thinking about is their harlotry. And when they can't get somebody, one of these passers-by, because it's just anybody that passed by, that you're his. Okay? When they can't get that, then they'll deal with the image. It's pretty disgusting what Yahweh's saying here. When you get it down to real English, regular everyday 20th century English, it's pretty disgusting.
I was looking at a cartoon and it had.
Wait a second! I want to make a quick comment from a Pow Talk comment. I assume this comment is about our conversation, and it says, "How does this apply to us today?" Well, this is what I just was explaining before, is even as Israel was redeemed out of Egypt and is described as being adorned in a beautiful way, but trusted in their own beauty, how does it play today? That we, in our individual lives, in our service to our Creator, in our ministries, it applies because we... because of the principle that if things start going well for us individually, or things start going well for us in our service to Yahweh, in our jobs, in our ministries, that we kind of then say, we forget about Yahweh. And we say, it's because of what I'm doing, and your love for Yahweh waxes cold, and you don't give him glory. You don't stay in a state of praise and thanksgiving and giving him glory and being in a state of thankfulness. That will cause you to end up doing things in your life that will be analogous to playing the harlot. So you need to understand that the Bible contains many principles for our mm-hmm. lives that we need to apply to our lives. Now, Ron was making a comment, and I interrupted him, so you go ahead.
Okay, the application, we have a cartoon where we have our founding father, George Washington, and another father, Abraham Lincoln, are strolling through Washington, D.C., and they're looking and they go, Washington says to Abraham, well, at least yours looks something like you. And so we have this huge phallic symbol that's given over to represent our founding father.
Yeah.
Where have we gone as a nation? Let's go to Isaiah chapter 9 And verse 9, it says that this is Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria, asserting in pride and of arrogance of heart, the bricks have fallen down, but we will rebuild with smooth stones. The sycamores have been cut down, but we will replace them with cedars. This is exactly the verse that was used after 9/11 by the leaders of our country. They were quoting this verse time and time again. The leader of the House, many others, at different points in time, to reassert that this would not be an obstacle that would cause us to be set back, that we would actually do better, we would rebuild. And that's where the arrogance of our heart is today. We were a nation that was set apart. We are like a new Israel in many respects. We were. But we have become a harlot. We have turned our backs because of why? Because of the beauty that we were given. We've been given so much as a nation. You want to see the modern day application? Look at our nation. We have so much innocent blood that's being shed from shore to shore, and it cries out to the very throne of Elohim saying, how long, O Father, before you judge? How will you judge my innocent blood that's been shed across this land? Every day we have 1,300 babies that are being murdered every day in this land. More than what were killed at 9/11. Every day innocent blood is being poured out on this nation. And yet in pride and arrogance we continue to rise up and say, oh, nothing will ever happen to us. Nothing ever bad will come upon us. People ought to open their eyes and see. In California, they've already overturned the will of the people. In regards to Proposition 22, the state Supreme Court has said that homosexual marriage is now legal in the state of California. They've also made homeschooling illegal.
And they wonder why the state's on fire.
And the state's on fire. Maybe it's a sign, or maybe it's a word of warning to the homeschoolers that maybe you best leave California. The judgment's going to fall there. One of the major judgments that's supposed to fall upon California because they're leading the nation. And after this particular proclamation in regards to the state Supreme Court decision, many homosexual organizations have said that as a result of this, that this will be earth-shaking. In fact, one particular one said, this is an earthquake decision that has taken place in California. So, maybe he's speaking words of judgment? I don't know. Maybe Yahweh oftentimes will use the very mouth of a donkey to proclaim truth. And maybe this is exactly what will happen to the state because of what's being said and because of what has been done, because of the evil hearts of those that lead the state and because of the apathy of the people.
Kick the soapbox back under the table now, Ron.
Okay, we're done.
I got to tell you, the reason that Ronald is so passionate specifically about California is that's where he's from. The man is like 50 years old, and he lived 46 years in California. So, I mean, he's close to it. He loves the state, and I understand that. Anyway, comment that I had, Eddie was talking about, he was commenting on my comment. And I just realized, you know, Yahweh has given us gifts. Okay? And Eddie is a I hate to say this in his presence because it's gonna puff his up, it could puff him up, but Eddie's a great Torah teacher. Okay? He knows that. We all know that. But you know what? If he lets that become an idol to him, the fact that he's a great Torah teacher, okay, that's the same thing as what we're talking about here, but thou dost trust in thine own beauty. Thou playest the harlot because of thy renown. Okay? Thou hast taken thy fair jewels of my gold and my silver, which I had given thee, and madest to thyself images of men, and didst commit whoredom with them. If Eddie takes his great Torah teaching ability that Yahweh has given him and turns it into an idol in his life, this is where Eddie is at. And it's the same with any other of us. I don't know how many people are in the room, but whatever it is, you all have gifts. And if you hold those gifts to be yours and not what Yahweh has given you, then it's become an idol in your life. Okay? And that's where the rubber meets the road here today from this particular scripture. Okay? We all need to be aware of the fact that those gifts that we have are gifts. They're not necessarily talents that we have just because we're us. These are gifts that were given by Yahweh, and we need to relate to them in that way.
Any other thought, question, comment along this line with this thread? I'm going to go back to a comment on Pow Talk, and I want to try to find it. I think I'm about to find it. If not, I'll paraphrase what it was. Okay, the comment was, I thought that Ezekiel 16 was referring to Jerusalem. Well, it is referring to Jerusalem because it says in Ezekiel 16, verse 2,
who do you think we are?
Son of man caused Jerusalem to know her abominations. But I made a comment that Ezekiel 16 is talking about the nation of Israel that came out of Egypt. It is. That is because the nation that came out of Egypt was to go into the promised land, and ultimately there was a particular place in the promised land where those who came out of Egypt were supposed to go, and that is Jerusalem. And when you get to Jerusalem, that's the end of the journey. That's where the marriage takes place. The marriage takes place in Jerusalem. So therefore, a synonym for the nation of Israel who came out of Egypt and its completed state is Jerusalem. So that's why it's talking about the nation and it's talking about Jerusalem, because the two are linked together. Go ahead.
Not only that, it also is talking about us individually and us corporately. If you look in Revelation chapter 21, verses 9 and 10, it says this. I'm going to start in 9b. And he talked with me, saying, come hither, and I will show thee the bride, the Lamb's wife. And he carried me away in the Spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me that great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from Elohim. Okay? We are Jerusalem. Spiritually speaking, right now, metaphorically, we are Jerusalem. Okay? So, it is talking about us. It's not just talking about the city. If you only get the concrete, what's actually written on the page in the scripture, you're not getting anywhere near the truth. You're getting just the face of the truth. You're not getting the depth of it.
Going back to some of the original ideas in regards to the contest that's taking place between the powers of darkness and the powers of God, we have the situation after the flood where the adversary desired to control the Garden of Eden. In fact, Eddie read from Ezekiel chapter 28 where it talks about that Lucifer was in the Garden of Elohim. Now, Eden was that place. Now, after the flood, things were shaken up quite a bit in regards to the surface of the land. And so, geographically, right away, he moves different individuals into areas which would be possibly the site. That's why Nimrod took that place along the Euphrates River as a possible site, and that became the city of Babylon. And then also Nineveh, which he built as well, could have been a possible site, because the course of the various rivers were actually changed at that point too, because of all the shifting of the soils. But I believe also that's why he had so many of the descendants of Ham move further south, was to control these various geographical locations that could have at one time been the Eden that was the Garden of Elohim. And in fact, most of the Canaanite cities, they're founded in blood. And we talk about the abortion issue. Well, they practice a great deal of human sacrifice. And so when we talk about Jerusalem, the Jebusites were the ones that founded the city, and they probably practice a great deal of human sacrifice. Even the Masons, when they get the opportunity to, a lot of large building projects such as schools and government buildings and other large buildings, they will put various kinds of capsules which have certain types of objects that mean something to them into the very foundations, and they'll actually sometimes have a service of some kind before the beginning of the project. And so it is that the adversary wants to be able to get some kind of a foothold onto various locations. And so it was that Yahweh came along and sees this city. And this is the city. I believe that Jerusalem is sitting on the very place of the Garden of Eden. That's my belief. I don't know how many others will hold that. You might want to read the book by Ernest L. Martin. What is that book called? Oh, it has to do with... Anyway, it's a book by Ernest L. Martin. Anyway, in it he talks about the place and the crucifixion of Messiah Yeshua, and he talks about the Temple Mount area and how importantly it figures in to all the economy of God in regards to even the very origins of the Garden of Eden. Now, this is, again, just as a speculation, but it does play an important part. And so that's why when Yahweh came along and put it upon, first of all, Abraham's heart to take his son Isaac there. And so that might have even been a tip-off to the adversary. Oh, this has great significance that Abraham is being called upon to offer his own son there in this place, even when it was just nothing more than just bare mountains. There might have been the beginnings of a town or something that was there at that point.
Books by Ernest L. Martin.
Okay, anybody else?
Yeah, okay.
Thoughts, questions, comments on Ezekiel?
Oh, it's called the book by Ernest L. Martin is called The Secrets of Golgotha. Ah. Yeah, The Secrets of Golgotha.
Anybody else? Thoughts, questions, comments on Ezekiel 16? Okay, let's go to Psalm 58. The headline in my Bible says, A Prayer for the Punishment of the Wicked. Verse 1, Do you indeed speak righteousness, O congregation? Do you judge uprightly, O you sons of men? Yea, in heart you work wickedness. Yea, weigh the violence of your hands in the earth. The wicked are estranged from the womb. They go astray as soon as they are born, speaking lies. Their poison is like the poison of a serpent. They are like the deaf adder that stops her ear, which will not hearken to the voice of charmers, charming never so wisely. Break their teeth, O Elohim, in their mouth. Break out the great teeth of the young lions, O Yahweh. Let them melt away as waters which run continually, when he bends his bow to shoot his arrows. Let them be as cut in pieces, as a snail which melts, let every one of them pass away, like the untimely birth of the woman, that they may not see the sun. Before your pots can feel the thorns, he shall take them away as with a whirlwind, both living and in his wrath. The righteous shall rejoice when he sees the vengeance. He shall wash his feet in the blood of the wicked. So that a man shall say, Verily there is a reward for the righteous. Verily he is a God that judges in the earth. Corporately speaking, this distinction between the righteous and the wicked is a concept that's associated with redemption. In Egypt, there was a distinction made between the children of Israel who were in Goshen and the rest of Egypt. During time of exile, one can't easily recognize and see the distinction between the wicked and the righteous and what befalls them. During exile, the world's turned upside down. It seems the wicked in their wickedness continue to prosper more, and the righteous in their righteousness continue to suffer more. However, things get to its proper place in redemption, and at the time of redemption, for Psalm 58:11, So shall a man say, Verily there is a reward for the righteous, verily he is a God that judges in the earth. So, in redemption, which is associated with the end of days, when the exiles of Israel are gathered, and Malachi chapter 3, verses 17 and 18, it says, "And they shall be mine, says Yahweh of hosts, in that day when I make up my jewels, and I will spare them as a man spares his own son that serves him. Then you shall return and distinguish between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serves Elohim and him that serves him not. For behold, the day of Yahweh comes." Notice the day of Yahweh is associated when he makes the distinction between those who serve him and those who do not. Yes, and this is the prayer of Psalm 58, that Yahweh would make a distinction between the righteous and the wicked. And speaking about our human nature, wickedness, it says, verse 3, "The wicked are estranged from the womb." What does that mean? That means in our flesh, in our nature, what we inherited from Adam, is a nature to want to rebel and to please the flesh. You don't have to teach an infant to be selfish. They fight for themselves, and they automatically... That's right. You got to teach them and train them to be good. They do by nature what is self-serving to them. And this is because of the nature of man. Anybody with thoughts, questions, comments regarding Psalm 58?
Yeah, we were just having a sidebar over here, and I remember a comedian on the TV saying one time, "We have troubles with our children because we don't beat them enough." He says, "Beat your children. Beat your children. Do not kill them, but beat them until they understand that they can't do things the way they want to do them." Yeah, today you can go to jail for that, because somebody will go, that man is spanking his child. Oh, that's child abuse.
Actually,
child abuse is not beating your children.
The Bible says train a child. So train a child in the way they should go. Train. How do you train them? By reminding them, showing them manners, how to be nice. And, you know, by and large, not absolutely, but by and large, children are reflective of their home environment. Their manners are reflective of their home environment. Their values are reflective of their home environment. So how do they acquire that? It gets trained in them. So we have to train our children in righteousness. So Mark, there's always people, as we know, by being in the public, being on Pal Talk, no matter what we say, they can twist and distort.
Oh, absolutely.
Our words,
absolutely.
And take what we say to their own imagination.
Yes, now remember something, all you
so
folks
you have
out
a disclaimer,
there.
Right?
Remember something, all you folks out there. That's right. The opinions expressed by the people in Beit Yaakov Hebraic Congregation are the opinions of those people expressing them, and not necessarily that of Beit Yaakov and of Hebraic Heritage Ministries International, although they should be.
Yeah, it's interesting how those that are identified with the unrighteous, the ungodly, that they're also linked to the serpent, to the venom of the serpent, or like a deaf cobra, which takes us back again to the contest that was there in the Garden of Eden, when the serpent was being used by the adversary, the devil, to trick the original couple. So this is a contest that is going to continue on until we have the very ending of the verse 10 and 11, where we see the vengeance of Yahweh, where he brings, he's going to bring them into that valley of decision, where they're going to be gathered together. And And in that valley of decision, he's going to bring about great glory to himself. It talks about how Messiah himself will come from Edom, and his garments will be stained from treading the winepress of the wrath of Elohim. And so it is that he is the righteous one who will have his feet washed in the blood of the wicked. And sure, there is a reward for the righteous, because God will judge the earth.
Anybody else? Thoughts, questions, comments regarding Psalm 58?
I just love some of the wording.
Go ahead.
Do you indeed speak righteousness, O congregation? Do you judge uprightly, O you sons of men? This psalm is speaking about the great wickedness on the earth. Yahweh's vengeance, and Yahweh's vengeance on its account. The wickedness is so great that wickedness is considered good. Okay? Just like today, by the way. Ye in your hearts, in heart ye work wickedness. Ye weigh the violence of your hands in the earth. You're saying, I'm not as wicked as that guy is. Okay? I'm weighing my wickedness against his wickedness. And I'm not weighing our wickedness against the righteousness of Yahweh. So, you know, he's trying to get the point across to us that we're all wicked.
There is a distinction between those who know they have had wickedness in their life but have chosen to follow the ways of Yah through the Torah, through Messiah Yeshua, and experienced forgiveness and redemption, and who are entering into a greater salvation through this betrothal process. I know you know that,
yeah.
But we're looking forward to the distinction that he's making even more clearly between the righteous and the unrighteous.
Right,
Setting apart.
The whole idea here is that right here at the beginning of Psalm 58, it's talking about mankind in their natural state. And that's the idea behind the wicked are estranged from the womb. They go astray as soon as they be born, speaking lies. And that's where the whole thing started, you know, beat your children, don't kill them. because you have to train them to not speak lies. You have to train them that, you know, everything is not yours, you know. Because, you know, when you walk up to a kid and you share your toys with Johnny, and he says, "No, it's mine." You know, and every kid is like that. I mean, you can't get away from it. Every kid is like that. It's human nature.
I don't know.
It has to be trained out of them to say, "Well, okay, I'll share that with Johnny."
Oh, well, I was just going to be facetious and say, "Oh no, I was a perfect child. I did everything my parents wanted me to do."
Oh yeah, right, liar.
But I think about Romans chapter 9, where we read about how he has prepared vessels of honor and vessels of wrath, and how he bore with great patience vessels of even for his wrath, like Pharaoh, that he hardened his heart. But Pharaoh's heart was already had a predisposition to that hardening. He already had a heart that he wanted to stand up against the ways of Elohim and not come unto righteousness, not to seek the paths of righteousness and mercy and justice. And yet he has a purpose and a plan for those, just as he's raised up even the adversary to be a tool in his hand to cause us, those of us who will receive of his mercy and grace, the opportunity to be able to grow thereby. Because it's through these difficulties, these trials, that we actually appreciate what he has done and what he's doing. We appreciate his love. We appreciate his mercy. It's like if you just have a child that's totally protected all its life, it never really has the opportunity to see the more difficult, the challenges that it could have gone through, and never really realize the depths that the redemption has cost. It's like Messiah, when he's talking about those that are coming out of great sins, that those whom much is forgiven will love much. And so there is certainly a cost being involved with iniquity and being caught up with the challenges to the life. But through those great challenges, there can be a greater appreciation for the grace and the sustaining mercy and redemption of Elohim.
Well, Ron, how are precious stones made?
Wait.
Go ahead.
Well, they're made by polishing.
By pressure.
Pressure, yeah.
So you can't get that finished work that is so precious unless it goes through pressure, which is exactly what you were saying. Well, and we are called to be precious stones.
The pressure creates the raw, the rough precious stone. After the pressure has created the rough precious stone, then it needs to be cut and trimmed and made so that it's made into a beautiful stone. And that's what... So the pressure comes, and let's say the pressure leads us to acceptance of Yeshua as our Savior. Okay? Right. Made to be the beautiful stone that He wants us to be.
Have all those beautiful facets
so you can see all the beautiful colors and the different parameters of that stone. Okay, it goes on for probably into eternity. I have a feeling that even after we have our new bodies, we're still going to be.
Well, even Ephesians. I mean, in Philippians it says, I think it's 1:6, I'm confident of this very thing, that he who has begun a good work in you will continue to perfect it until the day of Messiah Yeshua.
That's right. That's right. That's right. What are you guys?
Just getting back to the people in their natural state, back to verse 3, 4, and 5.
Unredeemed men.
Unredeemed men, yeah. I mean... Verse 4, their poison is like the poison of a serpent, and are like the deaf adder that stoppeth her ear, which will not hearken to the voice of charmers, charming never so wisely. Okay, I mean, they will, the natural man will not listen to the wisdom of Yahweh. No matter how wisely somebody puts it to him, he will not hear it. He will not shema. He will not hear and obey the word of Yah.
Well, yeah. I mean, here's an example. You have this huge pillar of fire keeping you from being able to attack your adversary.
Yeah.
And then you look beyond that pillar of fire and you see this huge body of water divide, create an opening for this enemy of yours to pass through. They're 3/4 of the way through. They're 3/4 of the way through. And then all of a sudden this pillar of fire lifts up out of the way. And what do you decide to do?
I'm going
to go after him. Not me.
Anybody else, Mark?
Well, what Ron just talked about is verse 6. Break their teeth, O Elohim, in their mouth. Break out the great teeth of the young lions, O Yahweh. Is that not what happened to Egypt? They wouldn't listen, they wouldn't listen, they wouldn't listen. They saw, all of a sudden, I've got my chance. Is that not exactly what's going to happen with Gog and Magog at the end of the millennium? I mean, it goes on forever and ever and ever until Yahweh just decides at that particular point, Gog and Magog, I'm sick of it, and he devours them. Sends down fire out of heaven and devours them. And then the new heaven and the new earth come. After the great white throne. In the new heaven and the new earth, no worries about that because evil inclination, sin nature is removed. So.
Anybody else? Thoughts, questions, comments? Psalm 58. Okay, let's go to our Brit Hadashah portion. Matthew 23. Verses 1 through 28. Matthew 23, 1 through 28. Verse 1, then spake Yeshua to the multitude and said, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Now, Moses' seat is an expression that describes having a place of authority to teach the Torah. So it says the scribes and the Pharisees have a place of authority to teach the Torah. They sit in Moses' seat. And this comes from in the Torah when the children of Israel came to Moses and asked them questions regarding the Torah, and Moses then answered their questions. And it goes back to Exodus chapter 18. And verse 13, and it came to pass on the morrow that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood by Moses from morning until the evening. Moses sat to judge the people, or to give them the instructions of Torah, and the people stood, he sat to judge the people, sat to teach the people. So, about what this in principle is speaking about, Matthew 23:5, by all their works they do for to be seen of men, they make broad their phylacteries and enlarge the borders of their garments. This in principle speaks about people who want to appear religious before other people. They want to appear religious before other people, and they're more interested in the show to be approved by man, rather than being what later here we're going to see, verse 11, what should be the heart of a leader. He that is greatest should be your servant. Whoever will exalt himself shall be abased. Religious people try to show something that shows they're religious, wherein one who is a servant, his heart is focused on serving the Almighty, even if it embarrasses him in serving. Ron, you had your hand up.
Yes, I was thinking that Messiah Yeshua was not hypocrite, nor was he one to have a double standard. And so, when he's speaking to his disciples in regards to this issue, he himself, on several occasions, healed on the Sabbath, even though the Pharisees stood against him, forbidding him to heal on the Sabbath. There were other things that he did that went against the things that they were teaching. And so here, he would not be asking his disciples to do something to comply themselves to a standard that he himself did not comply himself to. What he was referring to is that, of course, the laws of the Moses had given, and as they would teach according to the laws of Moses, those things were those that his disciples, the disciples of Messiah, should keep, so that they would not be found going against the established authorities. And there's no established authority but that which is established by Elohim himself. But again, he pointed out throughout the remainder of this chapter the double standard that they had and how they would show themselves to be special powers or abilities or nature, how they would set themselves up to be set apart, but not in a good way. And yet, inside, they were doing things of an evil nature, just like what we talked about in Psalms 58. They were actually setting themselves up against the very government of God when they were there to represent the government of God.
You mean the readings tie together?
I certainly hope that the readings tie together.
It goes on to say in verse 6, they loved the uppermost rooms at feasts and chief seats in the synagogues. Notice what a religious person will do. A religious person will pursue a place of status and will pursue other men acknowledging their place of status. The contrast is once again verses 11 and 12. But he that is the greatest among you shall be your servant. Whoever will exalt himself shall be abased, and he that shall humble himself shall be exalted. Yeshua is trying to show that a true leader is not one that's got to seek a position to be seen of men, but a true leader is going to be one that is a servant of the people. Servant leadership. And so now it goes on to say, and greetings in the markets to be called of men, Rabbi, Rabbi. But be not ye called Rabbi, for one is your master, even Messiah, and you are all brethren. Now, you have to read this in context. It says, but be not ye called Rabbi, for one is your master. In other words, what he's communicating is, don't put a man of religious authority above the Creator himself. Don't put the Pope above the Messiah. Don't put the Rabbi above the Torah.
Or Eddie.
Don't put who? Mark?
Or Eddie.
Or Eddie.
He just grimaced when he
said
that.
Above the Torah. And so, this is what religious people, especially young religious people, have a tendency to do. It says in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 1, I, brethren, could not speak unto you as unto spiritual, but as unto carnal, even as babes of Messiah. For while one says, I am of Paul, another, I am of Apollos, are you not carnal? But who then is Paul? Who is Apollos? But ministers by whom you receive, you believed, even as the Lord gave to any man. I have planted, Apollos watered, but see, God gave the increase. It's God doing it all. He's the one doing it all. He's pointing you and directing you to individuals who are teachers of His words, who are servants. But it's God that's the one that gives the increase. So, call no man rabbi is one says, I am of Paul, another says, I am of Apollos. You're looking into an individual as your authority. And so, what Messiah is teaching is, don't look unto a religious leader as your authority above the God of Israel, because He is your master. So what? What if you put a religious person above the God of Israel? You know what you're doing? You're committing idolatry. You're committing idolatry. You're breaking one of the commandments by looking at your religious leader who wants to be seen as an authority and does not give Yahweh glory. This is the principle what is being taught here. Because it says in verse 9, and call no man your father upon the earth. Well, if you just read that, starting in verse 9 and not reading the context, that means children are not allowed to call their parents or their male parent father. Does the word mean? No, it means don't call anyone your authority above the God of Israel. Because it says, call no man your father upon the earth, for one is your father which is in heaven. In other words, your father in heaven is your authority. It says, neither be ye called masters, for one is your master, even Messiah. Then he that is greatest among you shall be your servant. So, reading this whole thing in context, what is Yeshua condemning? Is he saying that no one's to be called a rabbi, no one's to be called a father? No. What he is condemning is religious figures seeking a religious place of authority, and from that religious place of authority, to get the praises of men above the God of Israel, rather than your leaders being servants of the people. That's the whole point of what he's trying to make. Anybody in the congregation or in Pow Talk have any further thoughts, questions, comments?
Verse 5 says, but all their works they do for to be seen of men. Doesn't say anything about the works of Torah, Yahweh's works. Talks about their works. So, I don't think that Yeshua is. I don't think Yeshua is criticizing Pharisees and scribes as a class, but specifically the ones who act like this.
Right. Now, so does the Torah command that we wear what's called phylacteries?
Yes.
Does the Torah command we wear what is called tzitzit?
Yes.
Fringes on the worn of the garment.
It does.
So here he's condemning people who are following Torah in the literal sense. They're wearing phylacteries,
yes.
They're wearing tzitzit. So therefore, it's possible to wear phylacteries and tzitzit and be doing it in sin.
Absolutely.
If your heart is not right, it goes back to what we were making a point before.
Right.
That the outward is not meaningful, even if the outward is doing a commandment, if it's not done with the proper heart and the proper heart attitude.
That is correct. Yeah, it's not the matter that they were wearing tzitzit. It says that they enlarged the borders of their garments. They enlarged the tzitzit. They long tzitzit so that, you know, you can't miss them. You know? It's not a matter of they're following the commandment. It's a matter that, you know, look at the strings on that guy's garment, will you? That thing hangs down to the ground. Well, you can't miss that, can you? Hey, man, how come you're wearing that string that long? You know, I got asked the other day about the ones that I wear. Now, they're only like 6 or 8 inches long, right? I was asked about them. They're not obtrusive. I mean, I get asked about it once in a while, you know. What are those things? Well, the other day, same thing happened. I'm out working, and the guy that I'm working with says, what are those strings hanging off you? Well, and I told him what tzitzit were for, and, you know, the three reasons for them. To do what Yahweh said, to remember to do what Yahweh said, and to get people to ask. But you know what? The long things, it just says, oh, look how spiritual that guy is. Look at the size of the tzitzit that guy wears.
I believe Yahweh is addressing the heart attitude of those who are wearing it. They were wearing it in pride. Okay, so that's what he's condemning, the heart attitude of pride regarding religious observance. Now, why, excluding the heart attitude, just in and of and by itself, why were the phylacteries enlarged and the borders of the garments enlarged? It goes to the principle that if Yahweh wants you to do a commandment, do the commandment with all your heart and do more than what he asks of you. Do what he asks of you, but do more. It's called beautifying a commandment. Go beyond the letter of the law. do the spirit of the law. If the law says go 1 mile, go 2 miles. So you are going to do. So it is a good principle to do more, to go farther. If the Torah says give one coat, give two. So that is good. But if you're given two coats to be seen of men, in other words, Yeshua was addressing this in the temple, right? The guy who was supposedly had more money, who was giving proportionally less, wasn't given with the right heart. He was given to clang, make the sound clang like he's giving more. But the widow came and gave all that she had, with the right heart attitude. And so Yah was condemning the attitude in which it was done. He wasn't condemning in and of itself that the phylacteries were broad and the borders were enlarged. It was they were doing it to be seen of men. So once again, it all goes back to that heart attitude, that your heart is a holy of holy place.
That's right. It's a matter of in this particular case, it's a matter of getting the approbation of men, getting men to say what a great servant of God he is. You can tell by the phylacteries, the great broad phylacteries and those great big tzitzit that he's hanging up. Okay, just to get the praises of men, not to get the praises of God. That's the whole point, is to not be ostentatious. Okay, in your observance of the commandments, but to be set apart because you are observing the commandments. You know, that is going to be enough. The people who are in tune with what Yahweh is leading them towards will see that you're different, and that's what holy means, to be different.
Actually, Mark, if you're wearing those tzitzit and those around you who are observing your heart and your lifestyle is worldly, then you are actually desecrating.
Yes, exactly.
and bringing harm to Yahweh, his Torah, by proclaiming that you're a follower, but your life not having the fruit.
Exactly.
So therefore, we need to very carefully weigh what we do externally to make sure our heart and the way we live our lives will enhance something we're doing religiously outward, and not hinder and cause others to stumble or not want what we have.
Correct. Are you hearing this, Phil? Just want to make sure. You know.
Got it.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that you had a lot when you were saying that we don't want to do it to, you know, to draw attention to ourselves or to replace the sense that we haven't an adequate amount. Like the fruit of having God working in our lives, of having His presence among us or upon us. I heard a story that during the early days of the Azusa Street Mission and with Amy Simple McPherson and outpouring of the Holy Spirit, that as there was less and less of the Spirit being evidenced, that for some of her mission works, or at least as far as the sanctuary, that she said, well, let's bring in a few more trees and a few more things to kind of decorate the sanctuary, to kind of give it, because we want to have someone to hold the attention of the people. And it's man's way of trying to supplement the actual presence of God.
Is that kind of like barking in the Spirit?
I don't know if that's the case. I think we're deviating a little bit there. But actually, what I'm trying to point out is that when we don't have the actual presence and power of God working so that there's the manifestation of the various fruits, the fruit of the Spirit, and also the various manifestations of what works Messiah Yeshua said, these very same works which I do, you will do as well. And so when we don't have those, we have a tendency to kind of, well, let's try to find some way to supplement, which is going to maybe put on a garment or an attitude or a way of presenting. Like even, you know, what we're doing here with the Midrash. I mean, I'd hope that my own heart. There's probably various selfish reasons for why I'd want to be able to get on and expound on what I believe. And I hope that that's not going to satisfy my longing for more of Elohim. Because I think that by putting yourself in the place of Elohim, you removed some of the sense of desire for having Him there and having Him glorified and magnified. And that's what I don't want to get there. I want to be away from there into having more of Him. But because of this sinful nature, you know, we have a tendency to go there. And I know I have a tendency to go there as well, to try to supplement the power and the presence of God with something else. And we need the power and the presence of Messiah Yeshua in our lives, that so that the world may know the love of Elohim through Messiah Yeshua among the brethren, the power to be able to see people healed of diseases and raised from the dead. These are things that were promised to us, and yet it's in the third world nations where more of this power and the presence of Messiah Yeshua is being manifested.
I was making a comment about if you're doing a religious outward symbol, but you don't have a lifestyle that backs it up, you become a negative witness of what you're testifying to. So we had a Pal Talk comment regarding that, which says, "Reminds me of bad drivers with fish symbols on their vehicle. The witness is tarnished."
Yeah, that's pretty good.
So if you can't drive well, don't put a fish symbol on your bumper.
I'm not perfect. I'm just forgiven. As you cut the guy off and drive him into the guardrail. Yeah, I know. I do that all the time. That's right. I'm not speeding. I'm qualifying. in light of we were talking earlier about the fences that were built around the Torah. Fences that were built were put there to keep us far enough away from Torah that we couldn't break it. But you know, if you're kept far enough away that you can't break it, you're also kept far enough away that you can't keep it. So it's a good idea to forget about the fences. Tear them down. I think that would be kind of like tearing down strongholds that Paul talks about, tearing down the altars, okay, in the Tanakh. That's what we ought to be doing. Tear those things down so that we can get intimate with Yahweh, because you can only be intimate with Yahweh by following His commandments. So you have to be next to Him before you can follow Him.
Okay, it says verse 13, "But woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men. For you neither go in yourselves, nor suffer ye them that are entering to go in." So notice what Yeshua said here, that you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men. In other words, what he's saying, you're being a bad witness. You're preventing others from wanting the kingdom and wanting to be a part of the kingdom. You see his point? His point is you're being a bad witness. "For you devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayer. Therefore you shall receive the greater damnation." There is a verse. Maybe I can find it, where it says, "Don't desire to be a teacher, because a teacher will have a greater judgment." So it talks about here receiving the greater damnation. So with a position of responsibility comes responsibility. So if you're a place of leadership and you're doing hypocritical things, you will receive a greater condemnation than if you're not in leadership and doing hypocritical things. So don't seek to be a religious person in a place of authority and having the wrong heart and attitude and making the wrong witness, because you have a greater judgment. You have a greater condemnation. You have the verse there in James? Wait, you got to grab your mic.
James 3:1 says, "Let not many of you become teachers, my brethren, knowing that as such we shall incur a stricter judgment." And then it goes on to say, "For we all stumble in many ways. If anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body as well."
Okay, verse 15. "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you compass sea and land to make one proselyte, and when he is made, you make him twofold more the child of hell than yourselves." What's he saying here? He's saying you go to bring one into your faith, but instead of teaching them the word, you end up teaching them your doctrines, and they watch and observe your hypocrisy, and you bring in someone into the kingdom, and you corrupt them, basically. Verse 16, "Woe unto you, you blind guides, which say, whosoever shall swear by the temple, it is nothing, but whoever will swear by the gold of the temple, he is a debtor. Ye fools and blind, for whether is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And whosoever shall swear by the altar, it is nothing, but whosoever swears by the gift that is upon the altar, he is guilty. Ye fools and blind, for whether is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift?" So the altar is what sanctifies the gift. A religious person will magnify the gift, but a person who knows the word will value the altar, or that which the gift is placed upon, or the attitude heart in which it was given. Ron?
Yeah. Well, this goes to show you how far they are from the kingdom of Elohim, in that they don't understand that that which is very set apart, which is a gift given by Elohim to man to draw man unto himself, which is the tabernacle, which is the implements that are given within the tabernacle, is far greater value and of importance in the realm of the kingdom of God than man coming and bestowing a gift, some way of giving something back to Elohim. The greater gift is the gift that's been given by Elohim to draw man unto himself. Just goes to show you where their heart and where their mind, their theology was.
Continuing on, verse 20, "Whosoever shall swear by the altar swears by it and by all things thereon. And whoever shall swear by the temple swears by it and by him that dwells therein. And he that shall swear by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him that sits." So in other words, what he's saying is, if you're swearing by heaven, you're swearing by the throne of God and him that sits therein. In other words, your testimony and your witness affects the one who is sitting on the throne in heaven if you swear by his name. If you say, "I'm a believer," your witness becomes a witness of how people perceive the one who you're witnessing by, the one who sits upon the throne.
And in that light,
it's about sanctifying or desecrating the name of Yahweh by our behavior. Go ahead.
Which is a direct contradiction of the third commandment. Okay, to not take the name of Yahweh in vain. It has nothing to do with, you know, saying some words that, you know, that's not what it means, taking the name of Yahweh in vain. What it means is to do something like this, to say that you are a witness to him, and then be a witness to something else. Okay? I claim to be a follower of Messiah. If I don't do what Messiah does, or do as Messiah commands, how am I showing that I'm a follower of Messiah? I'm not. I'm showing that I'm a follower of something else, and if that something else is usually going to be me. And just make sure that your witness is proper. You know?
Yeshua said, Let your yes be yes and your no be no. Anything beyond this comes to sin. So in that, he's telling us, be very careful. It's a commandment. Be very careful about what you say. It's what has been said. That we don't really need to say, oh, to add more credibility or to put ourselves at risk to have to fulfill a commitment by swearing. I mean, we're putting ourselves in a place of jeopardy when you do that.
Yeah. If you make an oath, okay, in particular, I was reading it in Torah today or yesterday, forget which. Anyway, where it says, if you make yourself a surety, it was in Proverbs. If you make yourself a surety, be very careful. First, don't make yourself a surety if you can't of somebody else's loan. Okay, but if you do, you better make sure that that person has got the wherewithal to pay the bills, because there's nobody else to come against but you. And Yahweh will hold you to your oath. Okay, so when you swear to something, Yahweh is going to hold you to your oath.
Verse 23, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you pay tithe of mint, arise, and cumin, and you have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, faith. These ought you to have done, and not leave the other undone. You blind guides, you strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. I want you to notice what a religious person will do. This is a big problem in the Hebrew Roots movement. Is you will focus on one particular Torah commandment that you highly regard or value, that you like and you like doing. And so you emphasize it, and you make it an issue of contention with others because you try to place upon them your love or where you're at in your walk and what you are emphasizing. You pay tithe of mint and rising cumin. But in doing that, it says, you have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. A religious person will emphasize a thing that you need to do, wherein a real servant of Yah will serve his man, be a good witness, and he will walk in mercy and the weightier issues of the law, which is love, faith, and doing good and practicing good, rather than focusing on, for example, a religious person will say, why aren't you wearing your tzitzit today? Or why don't you always say the name Yahuwah? Wherein a person who's values the weightier issues of the law is, if they see a person in need, they'll help them out. If they see a place where they can serve, they will serve. And one that Yahweh loves will be seeking to serve others and to help out and to tend to the needy and the poor, where a religious person will forget about those things, neglect those things, and they will emphasize one particular commandment that is external that they do and like to do, and they want to impose on others and say, if you don't do this, I'm more religious and righteous than you. Go ahead.
Now, I think I understand what you're saying, Eddie. Now, if I'm in a situation where I'm among a group of, say, Sunday keepers, and I have the opportunity to share about Sabbath keeping, and I do it in a way that I believe is beneficial, it's not condemnatory, but I'm just basically trying to share with them some insight into the value of keeping it, because it is the first of his feasts, and just trying to present that as something that maybe they haven't been really exposed to, the truth of the issue of keeping Sabbath as opposed to keeping Sunday as a day of worship. That's a good thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, they're not only hearing what we're saying, but they're hearing how we're saying it, and our attitude in expressing it. That's what they're hearing as well as what we're literally trying to say. That's why in Ephesians it says speak the truth in love, which means you're supposed to speak the truth, but it's possible to speak the truth and not do it in love. But so you're supposed to speak the truth, but you're also supposed to speak the truth in love. And that's what we're supposed to bring to the table. Because Yahweh loves balanced scales. Speak the truth, but in love. You have a comment, Mark, or no? Okay, verse 25. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you make clean the outside of the cup of the platter, but within are full of extortion and excess. You blind Pharisee, clean first that which is within the cup of the platter, that the outside may be clean as well. He's continuing talking about the same theme. Religious people doing externally religious things without the proper heart attitude. It says, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like unto white sepulchres. You indeed appear beautiful outward, but are within full of dead man's bones and all uncleanness. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous unto men. See, he's summarizing the point. You appear outwardly righteous to men, to religious people, but within are full of hypocrisy and iniquity. That's the point. That's the point he's trying to make. Outwardly being religious, wanting to be seen of men, wanting to have the religious symbols, to have the best seats, for men to honor you, but your heart attitude is not right, and thus you are bringing desecration and dishonor to the name of Yahweh. So while Yahweh is using and directing these thoughts to a specific people in his day, it applies today to all those who name the name of Messiah. If you understand, Messiah is trying to teach you principles. A religious person won't see the principles. They will say, and they will use this condemnation of the Pharisees. If they have anti-Semitism in their heart, they'll use it as this is an excuse to be anti-Semitic, to be anti-Torah, to be anti-Jew. And this is not the heart that Yeshua is conveying here, because you just take out Pharisee and put in any Christian leader, and the same would apply. Go ahead.
Okay. There's an excellent word in verse 25. No, actually, it's the idea that's in here. The word is actually seen in 2 Timothy chapter 3 in verse 17. I'm going to read 16 and 17 where it says, all scripture is given by inspiration of Elohim and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God may be perfect, throughly furnished unto all good works. Okay? The word's throughly. Now, in a lot of translations it says thoroughly. And there's a difference between the two words. Let me use an illustration. You got a gallon bottle with a lid on it, and it's empty. And you wash the outside of it, which is where Yeshua is coming from, is the tie into this gospel passage. Okay, you wash the outside of the bottle, it's thoroughly clean. But you haven't washed the inside of the bottle. It's not clean throughout. It's not thoroughly clean. Okay? Now, we can be thoroughly furnished unto all good works, not just on the outside, but on the inside as well. And that's Yeshua's whole point in this particular chapter, or this particular passage. It says, you blind Pharisees, clean first that which is within, then the outside will take care of itself. Okay? So he wants them to be thoroughly clean, not just thoroughly clean. Okay?
And, you know, from our theme, from when we talked about the tabernacle to what you just said right now, we have a thread of what we've been sharing throughout this Midrash, and that is the Holy of Holies, the most holy place of our, is our heart, and we must protect and guard our hearts. And our heart has to be clean, and we have to be as diligent to keep our heart clean as what we are diligent to keep our external bodies clean. And it all boils down to the heart and the attitude of the heart. Because if our heart is right, if our motives is right, that's when and how His divine presence and His anointing can be with us and upon us. Is there any other further thoughts, questions, and comments? If not, this is going to conclude our Midrash for this week. We pray it's been a blessing to you, and it's helped and encouraged you to draw yourself closer to Yeshua, to His kingdom, to understand the ways of His kingdom. Until we do it again, Shalom in Yeshua the Messiah. Amen.